This is The Source on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Deep inside caves, at the bottom of the oceans, beneath the ground, even in subterranean lakes like our aquifer, there are habitats. There's no light, but there is life. In the dark, there are animal species that are strange and fascinating. They have adapted in ways that challenge our ideas of what Earth-based animal life is like. But many of these creatures have never been seen by humans until now. Dante Fenoglio has tracked these strange and incredible creatures down and has photographed them for his new book, Life in the Dark, Illuminating Biodiversity in the Shadowy Haunts of Planet Earth. And Dante is a zoologist, biologist, wildlife photographer, and is vice president of conservation and research at the San Antonio Zoo. And Dante, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. So, Dante, you have gone to some of the strangest places on the planet to find these incredible creatures. What is the furthest you've gone to find one of these amazing creatures?
So I've been fortunate enough to be part of a group that works in South China, and we explore the caves of South China, and the primary collaborator involved there is from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, a fantastic person, and he studies Chinese blind cavefish. It turns out China has more species of obligate fish that only spend their lives below ground than anywhere else on Earth. And so once a year I go over there and we climb through the caves of South China and look for blind cavefish.
And when you say you climb through the caves, what does that mean? I mean, you're like crawling on your belly through little holes, or what are you doing?
So it's a little bit of all of it. Some of these caves are enormous. You could literally fly a plane in, turn it around, and fly it back out. Some of them are not anything like that, and they're very crawly. If you're claustrophobic, it's not a good place for you. But it's fantastic to get into these places where there haven't been a lot of biologists and to see species that quite often are new to science, and it's really exciting that way.
South China, that's where you went. Also here in our own area, we have species like this that are never see the light of day, yet they manage to live.
We sure do. So Central and South Texas are really special because we have the Edwards Aquifer beneath our feet. And there are distinct pools in the Edwards Aquifer, and those distinct pools can have quite different faunas that live in them, a wildlife that lives there. But there are some absolutely amazing creatures that live right below our feet, including things like blind pink catfish, blind groundwater shrimp, and blind salamanders, just to name a few. There are all kinds of just amazing things down there.
People are familiar with catfish. They see them. Are these like that catfish, that size, that scale?
Not quite.
And so, we know that catfish don't have scales. I'm sorry about that. But
no, that's fine. So here's one of the really interesting things that comes up when you look at wildlife that lives below ground or in aquifers. What you have a very limited amount of energy available for them to consume, right? So on the surface, we have plants and we have photosynthesis, right? Plants making sugars from sunlight. And that's where the energy comes from at the base of the food web above ground. But below ground, there aren't plants. There's not sunlight. So you have to ask yourself, where does that stuff come from? And where it comes from is decomposition. And what I mean by that, you have leaves and wood and corpses even that wash into cave systems, that decompose in the cave systems, and that's where the energy is coming from. Likewise, you have bats flying in and depositing guano. There are some birds that also live in caves that can deposit large amounts of guano. Cave crickets can deposit huge amounts of guano because they feed on the surface at night where that photosynthesis is, and then they come back in by day and they defecate into the cave, and that material is broken down, and that's the energy that starts all of this. The reason I'm going here is this. Decomposition doesn't have a lot of energy involved with it. So if you start with a very limited amount of energy, that can only sustain a very few different species or individuals of those species. And it also tends to produce smaller things, right? So the cave crayfish are usually smaller than the surface crayfish that they're related to. The cave shrimp is usually smaller than the surface things that they're related to. And likewise, these blind catfish are not nearly the size of some of the lug nuts that we get out in the lakes and rivers here in Texas.
So this is indirect photosynthesis.
Yeah, that's a perfect word for it. It's indirect energy transfer. The technical word for it is allochthonous input. That means it originated someplace else, but it ended up inside of the cave system. That's just a big fancy term for saying the energy came from somewhere else.
And so these creatures, they become smaller in scale, but also because energy is so critical for them, they can't afford to have any appendages or anything that isn't going to help them survive. And so they lose their ability to see. Eyes are gone.
So that's a great question. And actually, why a huge group of unrelated creatures tend to show the same conditions below ground, that it's called troglomorphy, when you tend to lose your vision and you tend to lose pigmentation. And it's not that you lose your appendages. They get smaller. They become more frail. Sometimes they become more elongate. In salamanders, you can end up with more teeth than surface relatives. But that whole suite of characteristics are something known as troglomorphy. And why that happens and why it happens across very much unrelated groups of animals is hotly debated. And a very old hypothesis is that it had something to do with energy economy. Why invest the energy in eyes and pigment if you're never going to use them? That hypothesis comes and goes, and it fades in popularity. And there are a lot of competing hypotheses. I'm not sure, you know, what the exact answer is, but we do observe these same general trends across very much unrelated organisms or animals.
So these amazing adaptations that these creatures take on, sometimes they're able to, their heads become like shovels, or they're able to so they can find the food and reproduce.
Sure. So that's a really good point. And it's fascinating. If you look at what's happened in salamanders that have sort of evolved into subterranean habitats, in other words, they're only found in groundwater or they're only found in caves, generally what you have is a broadening and a flattening, a shovel-shaped head, right? The other thing that comes with that is an increase in the number of teeth. And the hypothesis behind that, and it's a very old hypothesis, is that with an increased number of teeth, you're going to handle potential prey items more efficiently, and you're not going to miss potential feeding opportunities, which may be few and far between and long periods of time in between. So you don't want to mess it up. And that's at least one of the hypotheses.
So these are critical lessons in life and how animals adapt to challenging circumstances, and how life will struggle to survive in the worst of circumstances. No light, few food, but also at the same time a very protected environment, very little temperature variation also in these places, I imagine. And so we're going to talk more about what we can learn about these creatures below our feet, around the world, in some of the darkest places. We're going to continue our conversation. You're welcome to call in. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The biodiversity on this planet is amazing. Animal life has taken hold in places that seemed too inhospitable, places that are too dark, that are too isolated, but they're not too out of reach for these creatures. Here we find otherworldly adaptations that challenges our concept of what earthly animals should be like. That's what Life in the Dark can teach us, and that's the title of the book, Life in the Dark, Illuminating Biodiversity in the Shadowy Haunts of Planet Earth. It's written by Dante Finolio, and he is a vice president of conservation at the San Antonio Zoo. He's also a biologist, conservation biologist, and a wildlife photographer and a zoologist. So, Dante, how does the zoo connected to you traveling around the world, going to South China and crawling on your belly like a reptile in caves, trying to find these? You know, is that what zoos do now?
You know, it sure is. And one of the things that that's really exciting. When I was going through graduate school, zoos were not even on my radar. The the opportunity came out of nowhere, and I can say that I really have enjoyed the position. One of the things that a good conservation program requires is a fantastic supporting cast. And the thing that I appreciate so much about the San Antonio Zoo is that the entire upper administration is wholeheartedly in conservation. It's what they want to do. It's what they want the zoo to be about. The support that I get from my colleagues is just phenomenal. And I've been fortunate enough. We've got a new young CEO who's energetic, and he's really wanting to turn the zoo inside out. He wants conservation and education to be at the forefront of our mission. He wants to upgrade and update exhibits and really take the zoo to new special places. And that energy is really exciting to be around. So I've really had a good time.
We've seen, we talked earlier about the blind salamander in the aquifer, and that was the endangered species that was used to first impose pumping regulations here in the Edwards Aquifer. And at the time, everyone was like, blaming the salamander for this problem of not being able to pump the aquifer out of existence. And so, so what is the zoo's role in trying to teach people about this creature and also preserve it?
Well, so we have a really special relationship set up with the Edwards Aquifer Authority, and we're part of a multi-year project where we are learning in our labs at the zoo. We're trying to learn how to keep and breed some of the species that live below our feet, and this is a collaboration with the Edwards Aquifer Authority and the fantastic people over there that care very much about the wildlife living in the aquifer. And it's not easy to take a species that's endangered and try to learn how to keep it. What are its needs? What are the needs of the juveniles? What are the needs of the adults when they're going into a reproductive condition? How do you keep the eggs? How do you keep the juveniles? What do they like to eat? What do they not like to eat? Do you have to change conditions? There's a lot that goes into figuring these things out. None of these things come with how-to manuals.
And so I would think that even is a harder challenge because they are in an aquifer and these special places where it's a very limited zone that they can live in. They're used to they don't take temperature variation very very easily.
Spot on. Yeah, that's a great point. Things from subterranean habitats typically don't respond to extreme temperature change well, because they're so insulated, right? So aquifers are surrounded by rock, caves are surrounded by rock. That rock will mitigate temperature swings in any one direction towards cold or heat. So none of the things that live below ground on a permanent basis tend to do well with extreme temperature changes.
Okay, let's go to our phone lines. Give us a call. Numbers 210-614-8980 if you want to join our conversation. Hugh is on the line. Hugh, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, recently they discovered that the famous Galapagos Darwin finches and their beaks were epigenetic, that the finches' DNA is pretty much the same. It's the expression of that DNA that gives all those adaptions. What I was wondering is, these subterranean animals, is their DNA pretty much the same as the surface ones? And what we're seeing is epigenetic expression and possibly acquired characteristics, Lamarckian style.
Okay, Hugh, thank you for that question.
So that's a great question, and what I would say is that the answer is a little bit of everything, and there are species here in Texas that inhabit springs, and when you look at the individuals that are living in the springs, they have fully functional eyes, and they have skin pigment, and it looks like your typical spring salamander. There are nearby populations that are only found below ground that don't have eyes, or they have vestigial eyes, or the remnants of eyes. They don't have much in the way of pigment, and they start to express what I talked about earlier in that shovel-shaped head, that the very distinctive morphological changes that come with it. In those circumstances, clearly there's something going on where the environment being inhabited by that particular population of salamanders is interacting with their genetics and producing some sort of phenotype. I would argue that there are other species like the Texas blind salamander where it doesn't matter how much light you expose them to, they're not going to lose that shovel-shaped head. They're not going to change from that silvery blue white coloration, and the overall morphology is not much going to change. So the answer is probably a little bit of all of that.
When you go to these dark places, what about bioluminescence, when the animals create their own light? Why do they do that?
So, great question. Bioluminescence is one of the things that has captivated me since I was a kid. Ironically enough, where bioluminescence is most prolific, they're in the greatest amount. We never see it because it's in the deep sea. In some communities, over 90% of the deep sea community can produce its own light. Terrestrially, on land, it's very uncommon relative to that deep ocean community. And there are a couple instances of bioluminescence in caves in New Zealand. You have the bioluminescent fly larvae that spin their own webs like spiders do, and they catch flying insects in those webs and then eat them. So they're predatory, and they glow in the dark. They use that light to attract flying insects into their web, including adults of their own species.
It's like a bug zapper.
Yeah, like a bug zapper, except that they eat it. And then right here in Texas, there is a very old documented case of a small, uncommonly encountered centipede that is also bioluminescent that is believed to live below ground. But other than that, you start to run thin on examples in caves. And maybe the answer to that is most of the other things living in caves aren't around light, and light wouldn't be advantageous.
Right. So everything else is blind, so generating light is not going to do anything for you.
Right. Right.
Okay, but in the ocean, it is a benefit.
Right. So in these deep sea communities, one of the things that stands out almost immediately, the fish are not blind. They have fully functional eyes, and a lot of the invertebrates, things like the shrimp and such, also have fully functional eyes. And the reason for that, the hypothesis for that is this communication of bioluminescence. And bioluminescence can serve as a lot of different things. So let's take some examples. You can have an anglerfish that has this modified ray coming off of its back that hangs in front of its head. That's called an ilium, and at the end is something called an esca. It's a little bulb that glows in the dark. Here's something very cool. The fish doesn't produce its own light. The fish accommodates a bioluminescent bacteria that lives symbiotically with the fish inside of its own esca. In other words, if the fish didn't have the bacteria, it wouldn't have the glowing lure and it couldn't feed. So that's one way bioluminescence is used in the deep sea to attract potential prey items. But just like that, there are animals that use it in very different ways. For example, you can have fish and squid that have the lower surface of their body covered with photophores. Photophores are the structures that produce light, and they match the dim light that's coming from the surface behind them. And the photophores on their bellies literally erase their silhouette. So if there's a predator down below looking up for a silhouette, they can't see it.
So like it's like their stealth mode.
Exactly.
Stealth. So that's counter-illumination.
Yep. That is exactly what counter-illumination is, yes.
And so and the animals developed this through, evolution, trial and error, and not having it would give you a competitive advantage.
It would help you hide from predators that are looking for you. Yes.
So looking, at evolution and the process of evolution, this is the perfect laboratory.
You know, I would argue that subterranean systems in particular are fantastic places to try to better understand evolution, because the communities are less complicated and there are fewer individual organisms in these systems for the reasons we discussed earlier. Low energy input, right? So whenever you can track all the players in a system, you can learn a lot more about how they're interacting and how forces may have produced the forms we see today. So a lot of evolutionary biologists look at subterranean things with a keen eye that way, but likewise, there are a lot of evolutionary biologists that spend time looking at deep sea wildlife, particularly now things around hydrothermal vents and cold seeps on the ocean floor. Those are places that are very exciting because they don't rely on photosynthesis in any way at all. In other words, if light on the surface stopped and photosynthesis stopped, as long as the mineral-rich superheated waters continue to come out of the floor of the ocean, these communities would continue, and that's because bacteria that manipulate the chemicals in the water to produce chemical energy, it's called chemosynthesis, Those are at the base of the food web. It's not a plant-based food web, and it doesn't tie into photosynthesis.
Right, so they're not getting their energy from the sun. They're getting their energy from the vents that are coming from, like, magma and whatever from the earth.
Superheated water.
Superheated
yes.
water.
Yes.
And that has all these extra nutrients and stuff that can that
right.
they can survive
right.
on. And that's given people thought about, like, extraplanetary life forms.
It sure has, and that's it's a really fascinating
Let me ask you real quick, though, before we run out of time. So just because these plants, these animals are isolated, does that mean that they're so isolated that they can avoid some of the harmful effects of humanity?
Well, actually, it's the opposite. Because they're so isolated, they're extremely vulnerable to our activities.
Tell me more.
So if you look at the distribution of most of the species that only live in caves in North America, the vast majority of those species are only known from a very, very small area. What that does is it renders them vulnerable to any sort of human activity on the surface that could interrupt that system, drastically change something in that system. Because the range is so small, a very small activity on the surface could really interrupt the community. And then we lose the species. There's nowhere else to go because it's a very isolated system.
So, and they're fragile. It's a fragile habitat.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what kind of situations are coming up that are endangering these animals?
So,
like we've seen here.
Okay, so one of the reasons, one of the many reasons we want to take care of the aquifer that we rely on, you don't want to see situations where we're spilling chemicals onto the ground and allowing those chemicals to get down into the aquifer. As a city, we are reliant on the Edwards Aquifer for our water. We don't want to think about that getting contaminated. A contamination event is particularly harmful to animals living there because there's nowhere to seek refuge. If you live in an aquifer and the aquifer becomes contaminated, you don't have anywhere else to go. You're stuck. And so these things are all very, very vulnerable to what we do. Likewise, if we draw down the aquifer too far, we've eliminated the habitat that these aquatic things live in. There's no more water. There's no more place for them to live.
All right, the name of the book is Life in the Dark, Illuminating Biodiversity in the Shadowy Haunts of Planet Earth. Dante Finolio is the author. He's a vice president of conservation at the San Antonio Zoo. He is a biologist and a wildlife photographer and an adventurer. And I thank you so much for coming up here and helping us understand more about these strange and wonderful creatures, Dante.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
And when we come back from the NPR news break, we're going to be talking about summer blockbusters or just busted movies. Stay tuned.